You are listening to 20VC with me, Harry Stebbings, and we have a first on the show today. For the first time ever, we have four guests in one episode, and these founders are all absolute OGs of the financial real estate market, building companies that I believe will represent hundreds of billions of dollars in enterprise value over the coming years. And so with that, I'm thrilled to welcome our first, Asaf Wand. Now, Asaf is the founder and CEO at Hippo Insurance. With over $700 million in funding, Hippo are setting a new standard for home insurance and offer protection for what's important to today's homeowner. Next, we have Nima Gamsari. Nima is the founder and CEO at Blend. With over $665 million in funding, they are building the digital platform, streamlining the journey from application to close for every banking product. Finally, on the founder side, we have Max Simkoff, founder and CEO at States Title. With $229 million in funding, States Title are using machine intelligence to create a vastly more simple and efficient closing experience for lenders, real estate professionals, and home buyers. And then what 20VC episode is complete without a phenomenal VC? And so with that, I'm thrilled to welcome Brandon Wallace, co-founder and managing partner at Fifth Wall. With over $1.3 billion in commitments and AUM across multiple different vehicles, Fifth Wall are the largest venture firm focused on the real estate industry and property technology for the built world. But before we dive into the show today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Check them out at carta.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20VC listeners get 10% off at SecureFrame.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com. But that's enough from me, so now I'm very, very excited to hand over to the real estate fintech OGs. This is a special episode.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
So this is a very special episode for me. This is the first time ever that we've had four guests on one show. So I'm really putting my moderating skills to the test. But I want to kick off today with a little bit of intros, and I'm going to be very strict in terms of timing. So let's start with like an introduction of you and what your company or firm does. Asaf, let's kick off with you. And then let's move on down to Brandon, Nima, and Max.
Sure. Asaf, I'm the CEO and co-founder of Hippo Insurance. In short, we're modernizing homeowner insurance, and we're trying to focus back on homeownerships and homeowners and trying to make their life way better and secure so they can actually live in their house and focus on the good things that are happening in the house rather than the bad things.
Brandon, your turn.
I'm the co-founder and managing partner of Fifth Wall. Fifth Wall is the largest, the most active investor in real estate technology. We are very fortunate to be early investors in all the companies and good friends with all the CEOs on this call.
And Brandon, the man with more funds than I've done podcasts. Like, I commend you for that one. Nima, your turn.
Hi, I'm Nima. I'm sorry. I'm founder and CEO of Blend. We're a software platform used by banks and mortgage companies to make their process of lending more digital, more data-driven, more mobile. And we work with about 30 to 40% of lenders in the country to power their mortgage process in particular.
Max, you're up.
I'm Max Simkoff, CEO of States Title. And at States, we're eliminating the friction, frustration, and expense involved with closing a mortgage. We're only 4 or 5 years old now, but have already become the 8th largest title and closing business in the United States and well on our way to becoming number one.
Wow, that was some of the most concise introductions ever. I'm so pleased that we've nailed that pitch well. Now, I want to start with, you know, we were chatting beforehand and the chemistry is just kind of so tangible when I listen to you ribbing each other. So I want to start with, you know, you guys met like 5 or 6 years ago and have played pretty instrumental roles in each other's journeys and growth stories. So in terms of learnings, I'm actually going to throw this out. I wasn't going to assign it to someone, but I thought, fuck it, actually, it might be better just to throw it out. So like from the relationships and interactions, what have been some of the biggest learnings from each other that impacted your own journeys, do you think?
I'll take the first stab. I think the interesting thing that's going on is that you learn really, really fast and soon. There are a lot of ways to be successful. I would say that when you look at the three of us on this call, Nima is definitely a tech lead and he's focused on tech and product and that component. And this is what his company excels in. Max is a beast in operations and sales, and let him run an Excel on his fancy PC and he can do it forever. And if I look at myself, I'm a lot more customer-centric kind of person. And the interesting thing is there are lots of ways to actually be successful and build really, really big companies. And it's not one way, it's not one path. And working with these people, and I have the privilege to call them friends, you actually see that you can go in different ways and then embed all kinds of components from each one of them. So I get perspectives from Max on operations, from Nima on the tech, et cetera, which just makes my company way stronger and better.
Max, I'm interested. PC man, what would you say your learnings would be?
Look, I've learned interesting things from all three of these guys. If I were to go down the list, I'd say, and a lot of them stick out from conversations or healthy debates that we've had in the past. From Nima, we had a conversation that sticks with me that has actually kind of become one of our foundational principles of how we build our business, which is the importance of being naive when you're launching a business. It's actually like ignorance is bliss. The more you know about an industry, the more reasons you have not to start a company or grow a business, right? It's too hard. Do you like understand the competitive landscape? Nima, I don't know if you remember this conversation, but we talked about how like naivete is like one of the most dangerously powerful skills, I think, of any entrepreneur. That's something I've learned to embrace. From Masaf, he taught me that if you think about life as a series of chapters in a book and you think you're going to read it 20 years from now, everything's going to be great. So when you're in a chapter that might seem like it's a disaster, just wait long enough and you'll look back on it and it'll seem great. And from Brendan, like I've just learned that like you can transform an entire industry just by like sheer will. People, I think, probably told Brendan similar to what they told me when I started States. Like Brendan, I think we had talked about this, that like you didn't want a sector focused VC, because the one thing VCs hate is extinguishing option value. So like when you're in a meeting with them, you're like, what's your typical investment size? Well, we do series B and C. And you're like, oh, we're looking for seed. And they're like, oh, we do seed investments too, right? We actually will do some seed. We'll do some series E and F. Like we might even do growth investments. And just like the sheer will of disrupting an industry like the venture capital industry, where Brendan and Fifth Wall took a sector focused approach to prop tech, is something that I found to be super valuable. Having narrowness of focus is key.
Brendan, I'm intrigued from your perspective on the investor side. What have been some learnings for you given that?
I mean, kind of Max touched on it. Like we just learned a lot through investing. Like when we started Fifth Wall, we had this sector focused strategy. And the idea was we're going to get a bunch of corporate real estate investors. We're going to get them to partner with the best in class early stage prop tech businesses, right? And good things will happen. But I think from like everyone on this call, I just learned a lot. From Asaf, I learned extreme persistence. Like we hadn't even raised our fund and Asaf was like, you need to invest in our business. And I was like, I don't even have a fund yet. I don't know how I'm possibly going to do that. But ultimately we did and we couldn't be happier to. I think from Nima, just kind of a really measured approach to working with corporates. Working with corporates is really hard. That is something we mediate, we kind of arbitrate, we live and breathe it every day. And I think everyone on this call intimately knows what I'm talking about, but Nima just has a very good corporate bedside manner that I think we've learned a lot from. And from Max, I think when we started Fifth Wall, we didn't recognize how synergistic the investments we were making as a consortium could be. Meaning everyone on this call has businesses that are highly synergistic with one another, but Max really took it to even the next level, which is our idea was our corporates would just buy the products of the tech companies we were investing in. We didn't contemplate that our startups would be buying entire businesses from our corporates, which is precisely what Max did. So Max kind of showed me like what is actually possible. Like the value of this network of having strategic LPs and startups is manifold and kind of multifaceted. And Max really figured that out to a level we hadn't even contemplated when we started.
Now, Nima, I'm going to throw a tough one out to you. And as Max mentioned, the hotly contested debates that you guys have had. When you think back over the years, what are one or two of the biggest debates or hotly contested elements that you've had that kind of stay true to you?
Well, very early on, and this is not necessarily with these guys, but you know, I think that the question of working with corporate clients, working with enterprise clients versus going direct to consumer, you know, was a big debate for us. And I think actually all the companies on Asaf's company, Max's company, they both work with enterprises and with consumers, actually. And so they kind of have best of both worlds. But early on at Blend, there was a lot of debate. Fintechs that were going direct to consumer were very hot. And so we were being pushed a lot by our investors and our people who looked at our business to say, our prospective investors to say, banks don't buy software, lenders don't need software, they're going to build their own stuff in-house. So just go and build a new lender and compete with them. And that was an early hotly debated topic. I think with these guys, with Max and Asaf, our debates are really just about how can we make things go faster. The guys on this thread, you know, Brendan a little different just because he's a venture capitalist. No offense, Brendan. But the guys in this thread, you know, because we're so ambitious and we have so much in front of us and this industry is still so much, I would say the real estate industry is so nascent. What we debate a lot is like, what's the configuration that's going to eventually get the end solution to reality the fastest? And we have differing points of view on that. You know, I'm focused all about distribution and how do I get every consumer in the world through enterprises to use a platform that can do this? You know, Asaf is like, I'm going to build the end-to-end journey and make it so that every part of that journey that the consumer has about owning, buying and owning and refinancing and refurbishing and all the parts of homeownership become delightful. And that's what Asaf talks about. And Max talks about taking all the friction out of the home buying and closing process. And like, we all just have differing views and we love to debate this kind of stuff because it's fun to have people to really challenge the things that you're building. And then of course, Brendan's probably watching us and saying, you're probably all right in your different ways. And like, I think all three of you are going to win. And so I would say that's some of the fun discussions that we have as a group.
There's one thing I would just add also, just a slight rebuttal to what Nemo is saying, which is like, VC is a pretty boring industry. Talk about an industry that's never been disrupted, right? No one does anything different in. And one of the things I've learned a lot from is everyone on this call and how aggressive and ambitious they are with their own businesses and reflecting on how we as a venture capital fund can internalize that. So a lot of what venture capital funds do is they like invest in the most dynamic, thoughtful, outlandish people, and they do the same thing every day of the week. We've kind of learned a lot from our CEOs and in different ways from everyone on this call.
Yeah, I want to move on to a potentially controversial topic. You know, we mentioned home buying experiences a little bit, and home buying locations have changed a lot. The exodus from Silicon Valley is real, certainly if you follow Keith Raboy's Twitter. So I'm intrigued, in terms of your perspective, what do you think about this exodus from Silicon Valley? And I guess, is this a seismic shift but permanently, or is this purely a COVID temperament short-term shift? And so I'm going to throw that out to everyone and anyone who wants to jump on that.
I'll jump on that grenade first and say a bunch of things that I probably regret later and may end up on the internet somewhere. I guess I would frame it by saying, you know, who was it that said the rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated? I think it's like kind of a similar thing going on here in that Silicon Valley, and it's like even that term's kind of out, like it's the Bay Area, right? Like you've got some of the most amazing academic institutions in the world churning out some of the most talented technical and entrepreneurial people located right next to like the center of where counterculture was born. You cannot take that out of this region. This area is going to only get stronger as a result of the dynamic change that's going through. The thing I will say on this topic specifically is like, I don't have an issue with people like leaving the Bay Area. You know, everybody's right in this country to live wherever they want. I actually think it's wonderful for people to go and experience different places. I have a major problem with people leaving the Bay Area and talking shit about it on their way out. So like, it's fine if you want to go somewhere else. Don't go somewhere else and like on your way out, tell us how horrible the area has become. And especially not if you haven't been involved in the community, broadly speaking, enough to make a statement like that, right? So like perhaps you've been involved in the entrepreneurial community, perhaps you've been involved in parts of the regional community, but unless you've been serving on the boards of nonprofits and talking with your local supervisor and donating money to community causes, it's probably best to go to your new community and vote with your feet instead of being vocal about it. I'll leave on a positive note by saying that I hope that the new communities that these people are going to, there will be more community participation, more vocal support of local government, more involvement with local community organizations. I'm hopeful that despite moving to a different part of the country, it'll help enforce and enhance somebody's participation in the community a bit more.
Can I take a differing point of view to that? Max and I have debated this a bunch. I actually remember getting coffee with Max right when I was starting Fifthwall. And Max was telling me, you got to be in the Bay Area. And we started Fifthwall actually in Los Angeles. And I agree with everything Max said, but I do think there's an echo chamber that exists in Silicon Valley that has actually perpetuated some of the problems in venture capital in the Bay Area and overlooking huge categories like prop tech. I'll just give one example. I remember when I was starting, I was getting advice from a whole bunch of VCs about how to build Fifthwall. And predictably, all those VCs were based in the Bay Area. And I was like, yeah, we're starting a prop tech fund. And they were like, what's prop tech? This was back in 2016. And they were like, do real estate companies even adopt tech? That's not really a thing. And in the same sentence, he asked me if I knew about this company called Juicero, which was this like company that like was like a Silicon Valley darling that like made juice with like some obtuse machine. And it was like, that's a lot of what can happen in Silicon Valley. So there's a power to it, but there's also an echo chamber that I think forces VCs and capital markets, but also entrepreneurs, to sometimes over-rotate towards solving Silicon Valley's problems, not solving the rest of the country.
I totally agree with that. And I just want to make one last point here, which is I'm not saying we don't have plenty of problems. We probably have more problems to solve than we ever have in the Bay Area. But my point is, let's solve them. Stick around. Stay a while. You might be surprised. We've got some of the most unbelievable, and this isn't directed at you personally. I mean, you started Fifth Wall in LA, and I think you made the case for like, that was a problem that needed to be solved. And you guys have established an amazing presence in Southern California. And now you'll establish an amazing presence nationally. I'm just saying that like, we've got plenty of problems to hear, and it'd be great if people participated a bit more in the community to try and help solve the problems before bailing out.
I have a slightly different view on the power of Silicon Valley. I think it's not the reason of universities. It's not the counterculture. Yes, it's a reason how it started, but I think the power of Silicon Valley is about the networking effect and the level of talent that you have. At any given point, if NEMA wants to find someone who knows how to build enterprise sales from $150 million to $1 billion, he can find 10 leaders to do that. And if he needs to find someone for $1 billion to $5 billion, he can find 7 people to do that. And same goes for every other component of growth. You want corporate development at a certain size, then you'll find that. You want people to grow a company in a certain speed in Google, in Uber, in Facebook, in whatever, and the big guys, in smaller guys, people that specialize just between $50 million to $150 million, and that's what they like. You always have the networking effect to find the level of talent and or the education and the mentoring. And I think that's something that is not really replicable in other places. Brendan, how easy it is for you to find top talent to work in Fifth Wall? It's just not an easy thing. So I fully agree. It's not the only place on earth, and there's a lot of other stuff. But now, if you want to build a company to scale, it's probably the best place in the world to build it. And it's because of the people that you have around.
Can I ask, how much of the exodus do you think is tax related? I find it coincidental that we've seen a huge spate of IPOs and a huge amount of liquidity, and then the exodus happening at the same time. Is there a correlation there? And how much of it do you think is correlated?
Who knows?
I'm sure it's correlated.
Maybe it's correlated that, you know, people going to Texas and Florida. Again, I think that's, I mean, maybe I'm being a little contrarian. Like, that's people's right. Like, if they want to move to another place for personal finance reasons, that's fine. Just when you get there, put your roots down and get connected to whatever community you've decided to be a part of. But Nima, you and I have talked about this, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts.
Well, I moved to the Bay Area 17 years ago, and it's given me pretty much everything. It gave me my college career. It gave me my poker career. It gave me my network. It gave me my first job out of college at Palantir. It gave me my co-founders who then started Blend with me in 2012. And I'd say, like, in some ways, the Bay Area is like, I remember growing up and thinking, I really want to go to Stanford because I want to live in the Bay Area, and that would be heaven for me. And you show up to Stanford and it is like heaven. It's like a country club, but nicer. I would say the two things I really struggle with now, and it's because the Bay Area has changed a lot, and there's been a lot more tech success, which has led to a lot of really expensive growth in housing prices, which means that the new grads that we hire at Blend, we pay them, you know, 150, 160K. We pay them good salaries. I made 60K in my first job out of college at Palantir. I think it was 60 or 70K, and I lived comfortably in the Bay Area. These people now, when they graduate, they make 150, 160K, and they have to live with no savings to live anywhere reasonably nice that's close to the office. And that's really tough. And it's hard for me to change that, right? Part of it is this like housing policy. Part of it is the way that the city has not built as much over time. Part of it is the way they tax properties. There's so many interconnected things that I have no way to really have a strong influence over personally. Maybe I do, and I'm being a little bit of a victim here, but mostly I'm focused on the business that I run. And so I'm trying to figure out what's the best home for the next 100, 500, 5,000 employees of Blend as we grow. So that's one thing that's really influencing my thoughts on this. The other thing is just the sheer growth of an investment in remote tools in the last 18 months or 15 months or whatever it's been, the amount of innovation that's happening there. Now, most of it's just like copycat Me Too type things, but there are some really powerful innovative tools that mean that people can work not as effectively, but almost as effectively from anywhere in the country, maybe anywhere in the world, as they used to be able to need to go in person. And so I can tell somebody with a straight face, I don't mind if you go to live somewhere else, if it's going to make you live more comfortably so that you can be here for the long haul. And I can give them that freedom, that optionality. And so I think part of the exodus, I believe, is caused by taxes, to your question, Harry. Part of the exodus, I think, is because people just don't like the politics of California. And I think part of the exodus is employers are now saying, you know, if you need to go somewhere else, I understand. And maybe some employers are like, I don't want to invest too much in the city because my people can't live in a great positive life here anymore because it's too expensive to live here. Cost of living is too high. So I think, you know, all those things, I do think San Francisco is going to take a really big hit. San Francisco in particular, maybe California more broadly, but San Francisco in particular is going to take a huge hit. And we'll see. I'll probably be wrong about this and somebody will replay this clip for me in 5 years, and that's okay.
Don't mind. It's just us. This isn't being recorded. Totally fine. I do want to ask that, you know, you mentioned that kind of people working remotely, and bluntly, COVID's brought about a lot of management and leadership changes. And so I'm really interested, when we think about the last year and the changes that one has to adopt as a leader, how do you think your role as a leader has had to change and evolve in the wake of the last year? Asaf, why didn't you start?
I think in one word, it's communication. You need to be a lot more thoughtful on external communication with the company. I think half of the company joined, never been a day in the office, never seen another person from HIPPO ever. You try to infuse culture into them. We always focus on hiring something that we call, you know, hiring missionaries and not mercenaries. But this remote work environment creates a bit of a mercenary environment because you never build any relationship with a person. You never infuse the culture of the company. So it's not a really big problem for them to leave and to move. From a leadership standpoint, it actually forces you to communicate a lot more and be very thoughtful in what you communicate. We were always very supportive on being transparent with our communication, being very open. It just needs to be more upfront. We share all of the KPIs with all of the employees. We sit down, we do a significant Q&A. We do all ends, which are way, way, way longer. We give, I would say, more time for different leaders to actually come and present themselves. Personally, I freaking hate this thing. I don't like this remote work. I like an in-person relationship. I'm more of an extrovert. It doesn't fit me personally. I think it's very, very difficult to do creative things and solve hard problems. The actual amount of work that's done on some silos is probably fine for engineers. They still close more tickets potentially. They don't have commute. Maybe it's effective. But to solve hard problem, I think you need interconnectivity of different departments to sit down and actually go through something. Creativeness also went down. You don't have a lot of people that have this corridor discussion, which is like, Max, can you come in here for a second? Let's call Nima into a room. I want to run something by you. What do you think? And then account for that. I think a lot of where I'm getting my basically pulse of the company is by walking around the office and just seeing. You can actually feel vacuums and you can feel when there's some tension and things like that. You can actually preempt all of that. So now I personally really, really don't like that. I'm trying to mitigate it by having more and more time, coffee chats, open calendar time. I don't know. It's an interesting experience because I think it might fit different leaders' styles. For me, it's not the number one fit, and I need to be very proactive in mitigating that.
Matt, how have you changed as a leader in this time?
Look, the experience that I think all of us went through last March and April, you know, around the real estate market, basically being on pause, that was pretty humbling. And I think one of the things that I learned and that I changed about, or at least I tried to change about how we were managing the company, was being more frequently candid with the entire company about what was actually going on. And this is something that I've learned from Sarah Fryer, who I've learned so much from her. Anytime I'm like, I have like a crisis of conscience on something related to leadership, I will call her and be like, hey, what would I do here? And she basically taught me, she's like, look, in times of crisis, people like to assume that leaders have a very specific strategy and they've mapped everything out and they know what to do. And the reality is like, we're just winging it. And sometimes when you tell people that that's what you're doing, that's the most comforting thing you can do. So that's specifically kind of what we did for a period of like 3 or 4 months last year. We did, I think it was like weekly all hands calls, and we have 1,200 people at the company. So we did weekly all hands calls where basically the purpose of the call was to tell people that we had almost no new information. It looked like things might actually get worse. Here were the things that we were now thinking about for that week. People knowing that you don't have the answer, you're not delivering them to the promised land. Again, this is very specific to a time of crisis. I felt like it reinforced a lot of the communication lines in the company where people were like, thank you for at least just being honest and leveling with us. So that was something certainly that I've endeavored to try and change about how we communicate across the company.
Brendan, I'm interested in your case. I mean, you are a founder in many respects with Fifth Wall, but it's also kind of the investment
MC Attach, and it's a slightly different dynamic. Have you had to change? I mean, the team's pretty big now also at Fifth Wall. Have you changed as a leader?
Yeah, I mean, the hardest thing in venture is how do you build that intimacy with a founder, right? Like everyone on this call, there was some interaction that was like the culmination interaction of when they decided they wanted Fifth Wall as an investor, and we decided we wanted to invest in them. And that sentiment, that feeling is very hard to conjure over a Zoom. I think every founder knows what I'm talking about, where you build that relationship with an investor, and every investor knows what I'm talking about. So it's different, and it's definitely harder over Zoom. I think the other thing that's just been unique to see is that we're kind of in a weird position because there's probably no other industry, maybe healthcare, that has been as profoundly affected by what COVID has kind of jarred loose in the economy. And there's these big existential questions now for like commercial office buildings and cities that we never used to ask ourselves. And so one of the interesting things also is like we're trying to build really high trust, really intimate, really dynamic relationships with our corporates because it's very hard to get their trust to engage with the CEOs on this call. It's very hard to build that. And that's also hard to do over Zoom. But what I would say is that we're seeing real estate owners for the first time since starting Fifth Wall 4 years ago, recognize that tech is no longer a nice to have. It's no longer about like enablement or like just doing one small thing better. It's actually existential to your business. The business of not having a point of view on tech is a losing strategy. It's the wrong side of history. And like that awakening, COVID has created in real estate companies just over the last 12 months.
Can I ask, does that change your strategy then? Because if you have this awakening within the corporate subset, shit, you could build like highly specific verticalized product offerings for each different type. And actually with the wave of capital that they would bring, be almost needed unless you had a mega fund, like mega fund. How do you think about how their awakening changes your strategy?
I mean, we've never seen corporates take a more forward posture on tech and tech adoption. I think everyone gets this is now an existential question. And this is true of every subsector of real estate, from like self-storage, data centers, to multifamily, to home building, it's everywhere. You're right. I think one of the things that is just surprising about, you know, we brought this up earlier, people thought prop tech wasn't a thing or real estate tech wasn't a thing. Now $64 billion has gone into the category in just the last 5 years. So it's a thing. And $64 billion is a lot of money. And even though Fifth Wall is the largest real estate tech fund, what we're increasingly seeing is a stratification of what that means. So when you start looking at fintech, everyone represented on this call, and then you start looking at smart buildings and climate tech, these are all fundamentally different things. And the applications to the real estate industry in different subsectors are very different. Everyone on this call sells into home builders, which is largely like a manufacturing business and is considered real estate. And that is so foreign from like self-storage, which is also a massive industry. One of the largest publicly traded REITs is public storage. I mean, literally that company is sheds with lights. So the difference in the needs and the requirements of real estate companies is getting more broad. And I think you'll see more stratification, more diversification in how corporates engage with companies like the CEOs on this call.
Speaking of kind of the increasing capital commitments to the space and how corporates are changing how they think about it, I'm intrigued when we think about, you know, our cap tables and the investors that we have with us on this journey. You know, the three of you on this call have this unique position where you can very much choose and select the investors that you want to work with. I'm really intrigued, and Nima, maybe we start with you here. How do you think about what makes like the very best investor at each stage? And what have been some lessons for you there?
Yeah, I wish I could pick and choose the investor. Maybe from the outside, it looks like we've had a really good run with fundraising. But I mean, most people don't understand the amount of transformation that's coming to this space, not just here, but all of consumer finance. And so it's been actually really hard, I would say, for us to raise capital, you know, over the last 8-9 years. But I think the most important thing for us as a business, as a company that sells to lenders and banks and builders and fintechs and whatever else to be the platform that they use, the most important thing to us is our customers. And so if I can find at any point in the journey, investors who can help us get more customers, that's the most valuable thing because it's capital plus you're also getting additional enterprise value created by that investor. And so like in our Series A round, it was A or B, it was like NYCA, which is a New York and California based fintech focused fund. It was like one of the first fintech focused funds. They introduced us to a ton of banks early on, which was super helpful. I think it's how we got some of our early bank customers. And our Series D, Fifth Wall, they brought us into the home building world. And I could not be more grateful for that because we ended up signing all the home builders or a lot of the home builders. And now they get to use our platform and we get to have them as customers and get to work with them to make their process of selling homes just a little bit better for their customers and a little bit more profitable for them. In our Series F, we raised from a fund called called Canopy, where all the LPs were banks. And so it allows us to be further having aligned interests with banks, where banks are an important customer base for us because they do lots of loans, not just mortgages, but auto loans, personal loans, credit cards, deposit accounts. They do lots of different types of things, and we want to work with them across their entire consumer financial journey. And so like for an enterprise company like ours, that's the most valuable thing. And it's like, it's so much more valuable that when we're given the opportunity to work with investors like that, we go out of our way to make sure we do it regardless of the price of the round. I think at the very late stages, one thing I think about is like, who's going to be sticky and work with us if we do at some point go public, or if we do want to have somebody long for the very long term. And so our most recent round was Tiger and Coatue, and they're fantastic and they have long time horizons for the most part. And so those kinds of things do also really matter to us when we're thinking about like, how do we make sure we have investors who are not just trying to push for a very specific short-term outcome.
Nice. Nasaf, how do you think about it?
I would agree completely with Nima that the most valuable investors you can have are those that produce revenue. I know of no problem in the business world that revenue doesn't solve. And I know of lots of problems that can cause a company to fail that have to do with not getting enough revenue. And that's influenced our journey. Our largest single shareholder, still a minority shareholder, but the largest shareholder on our cap table is Lennar, who Fifth Wall introduced us to. And they became our largest shareholder because we bought their legacy title business, which gave us a ton of revenue and distribution and data to build our business. And then I also think that like, and it's funny, like Nima mentioned something I think should be talked about more is like, you only see the press releases on the financing rounds and there are big up rounds and like massively oversubscribed. And like, it reminds me of a story I heard from a founder friend of mine 4 or 5 years ago. He like saw a friend of his who was also a founder. And he was like, and this conversation I guarantee happens like hundreds of times a day, where he was like, hey, how are things going with the company? And his friend was like, oh my gosh, they're so great. We're crushing it. We just like blew out our quarter. We just closed this big financing round, you know, blah, 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 blah. And he asked my friend, he's like, how are things going for you? And my friend was like, they're going pretty well, but you know, honestly, like I'm actually pretty freaked that like, we're not going to be able to raise money. And we just missed our sales target. And like this critical executive just left. And the same person who just told him like, we're crushing it was like, yeah, actually now that we can talk candidly off the record, like, I mean, I'm telling you, we crushed our number. We didn't really crush our number. We're having to shift into some new market. I also just lost this key executive. And this is what's happening for everybody, right? Like this is just so impossibly hard. And financing is one of the hardest parts about it. And so I think that to Nima's point, like when you're lucky enough to be able to select people on your cap table, that's great. But like mostly you're like trying to make sure that you work with good people. And I think all of us have been lucky, especially with Fifth Wall, in working with great people who are high integrity. They've got the right alignment of interests in mind. But you're also like, you're raising capital to drive your business. And that's why you end up with like a diversity of perspective and personality in your cap structure, which I think all of us probably have to some degree.
And this episode is sponsored by Fifth Wall, the leading...
I fully agree with Max and with Nima. From the outside, it always looked like it was very, very easy and people are throwing money at you. You always have to will and deal and make it happen. And I think having a round is never trivial. You want the right investors, the right terms, the right valuation. Then it becomes difficult. If you're willing to take it and half of the price that you're willing to take, it's going to be a very easy round if the company is doing well. And if you're willing to put and bulk in all kind of terms that non-market, trust me, it's not going to be a very difficult round. But if you want to have a fair term and the right valuation, the right investors, not rattle the boat too much, then it becomes a difficult market. And it's never that easy. So from the outside, it always look up and to the right. And when you're in the company, it always moves picks and troughs all the time. And it's never easy. It's a lot. It's a hard work. And the thing that you realize really, really fast, and I think all of us got to a certain scale now, it doesn't become easier. I think the companies are more resilient. So if they're getting hit on the wing, the chances of them dying is not as high as it happened in the beginning. But it's harder in many ways. You need to eat quarterlies. You need to constantly innovate. It's a lot harder to go from $10 million to $100 million than $1 million to $10 million. And it's not an easy route. And a lot of people fall along the way. And I think that's one of the things that nobody talks about. It's not getting easier. It's hard work. It's never up and to the right. It's not easy to close the right funding and the right round. And it's usually you don't have 15 different options. You're trying to have one option that you're willing to take and it's good enough.
Can I tell the contrarian view to this being a Fifth Wall advertisement? And I'll tell the dark underbelly of corporate venture capital investing with respect to everyone on this call.
Yeah, do that.
Because it's actually not that easy. Like, I think everyone gets there's billions of dollars of enterprise value on this call. So clearly all the companies on this call have been successful. And everyone intuitively understands that corporates like a home builder or like a major commercial brokerage can bring so much value. They can be game changers. They can be kingmakers for these early stage companies. That was Fifth Wall's seminal thesis, right? That is where we started the firm. While they have all this potential left to their own devices, corporates will make terrible decisions. And so I'm just going to give an example of everyone on this call. Again, we're talking about billions of dollars of enterprise value. And I'm not going to use specific names, but Fifth Wall was an early investor in States Title. And we thought it had a really unique approach to title insurance, not a particularly sexy industry. We obviously brought it to the home building sector. And the idea was, look, exactly what Max has built. But the response was, that'll never work. That just won't work in the early stage. We were like, okay, all right, we're going to invest anyway and kind of continue to show it to you. Fast forward 4 years, Max has acquired one of the largest like analog traditional title insurance businesses and reinvented it from the ground up. That's profound. Take Asaf. It was largely the same thing. Fifth Wall came in relatively early into Hippo and the response was, I don't think you're really going to be able to market home insurance that way. It just doesn't work like that. And we're like, well, that's one way of looking at it. It's probably the wrong side of history, but we're not going to take your word for it. We're going to invest anyway. And sure enough, now I think Asaf would say that relationships with the home building sector has been transformative to his business and brought them in. In Nima's case, like Nima had with Blend, one of the best software for a particular solution around mortgage origination. When we first started the dialogue with them, there was some company, I can't even remember the name of it. It was terrible. It was like a terrible business that the corporates were actually evaluating. We were like, no, don't look at that. Look at this. And sure enough, they did. And I think Nima would say now it's been transformative to their business. So I just want to be clear. It's not that corporates are kind of running towards the light on their own. They need like chaperoning to make sure that all that value doesn't get misdirected. And by the way, they're challenging to work with. Their incentives are different. It's very hard for an entrepreneur to want to accept a corporate onto their balance sheet. There's a stigma associated with corporate venture capital that to some extent we alleviate and kind of arbitrate for them, but it's very hard. And the last thing I would note, these things have network effects. We talked about this at the beginning of the call, but in our first fund, we had one, everyone on this call sells into the home building industry, so we're particularly focused on it. We had one US home builder in our strategic LP base. We're now with $1.4 billion under management. We have four of the top five home builders as strategic LPs in our fund. So what that gives the entrepreneurs on this call and other entrepreneurs access to is I think 1 in 4 new homes built in the US. And the reason is that those home builders, those corporates get attracted to the very companies that are on this call. So there's a real network effect and synergies to doing corporate venture capital well, but it's exhausting. That's why there's bags under my eyes. It's very, very hard to do well.
Oh, come on, bags under your eyes. You look more like Clark Kent from Superman these days. But
exactly. Bags under his eyes with a backwards NASCAR cap on and biceps the size of my neck.
I know. Here in Britain, like, it just doesn't quite work. But I do want to move into my favorite, guys, which is a quick fire round. So I say a short statement, and then you hit me with your immediate thoughts. And I'm very targeted with these questions. So hopefully it'll be the best moment of moderating that I've done in the last hour. So let's start with Max. Favorite book and why?
A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius by Dave Eggers. As you can tell, I'm very pro Bay Area, but a story of somebody's experience through tragedy and then rebuilding community in the Bay Area and having their eyes open to how wonderful it is out here.
2,700 shows in, I've never had that as a suggestion. So that's always welcome. Nima, hardest element of your role with Blend today?
Just always staying optimistic, always looking forward. Lots of things go wrong every day. And it's like, it's a grind, like Brendan said, and just our ability to stay optimistic when things take a long time. Sales cycles are long, implementation cycles are long, revenue is super delayed. People are telling us things are not going to work, and just staying focused and being persistent and having the grit to make sure that we are successful.
Brendan, what's the biggest misconception around corporate investors?
We talked about one, that it's easy, but I'll give another one, which is people don't realize how big a percentage they are of venture capital markets. So corporate investors represent 45% of all dollars into venture capital. Now, the bulk of that is at the later stage. But if you ask most people how much do corporates represent the venture ecosystem, they'd probably give you a number less than 10%. It's actually an increasingly large share. And I expect that sometime over the next decade, it'll be more than half. So corporate venture capital is here to stay and it's huge.
Wow, I have no idea it was that big. Asaf, this is a tough one. Sorry, it's probably the hardest one. What three traits would you most want your children to adopt?
I have two kids, and this is something that my wife and I think about extensively. I would say the three things that I care about, resilience and persistence, basically finish something that you started. Second thing is risk-taking, taking the right risk. I grew up and I was in the military where the motto was, who dares wins. And I want my kids to know that they can actually take the right risks. This is something that specifically in COVID, I'm scared of. I think we're getting more risk aversion in our kids. So I'm trying to nudge them to actually take more calculated risk. And the last component is independent thinking. I think in today's world, in what's going on with fake news, etc., I want them to have a certain buffer and to think for themselves before they're actually getting and absorbing any kind of information and be able to make their own decision.
Max, which leader do you look up to and why?
I would say Barrett Tone, who was the founding CEO of Express Scripts. The reason I look up to him is he spent the first part of his career in public service in a series of state government roles. He decided to take a risk on helping with the campaign of an attorney general who was running for the governor of Arkansas named Bill Clinton, and was then appointed to run social services for Governor Clinton, obviously learned from his own great leader, but left government to run kind of a flailing division of New York Life Insurance Company that he turned into a $16 billion revenue leader in the pharmacy benefit management space. And I would just say building a business is hard. Building a business that delivers amazing value for all stakeholders, like your employees, your customers, the distribution networks you're in, is like near impossible. And he did that on all fronts. So just an incredible leader building a really impactful business.
Nima, who's the best board member you've worked with and why?
Oh man, there's only a few.
Somebody's going to be mad at your answer. I don't envy you on this one.
Yeah. You know, I've gotten to work with Jerry Chen from Greylock for like 4 or 5 years now. And I just really enjoy the way he's willing to get into the weeds in our business when I ask him to, never proactively, never forcefully, but he's willing to get in the weeds and work with us on things that we actually want help with. And he puts in the hours. Whereas I think a lot of board members like to give generic advice that is from pattern matching. He will actually go and understand the business, understand from first principles the problem, and make suggestions that are like super thoughtful based on, he was an operator in his past, which has been a really big help in me assigning him credibility in his perspectives.
Penultimate one, we mentioned board members there. Asaf, what drives the need for outside board members and advisors?
The real reason is corporate governance. And the role of a board is to hire and fire a CEO and approve the budget. But what I think is the benefit of outside advisors and a board is to mitigate bias and to give more perspectives. We are in the weeds and we're in the trenches and we're doing everything to focus on the company. Sometimes it's good to have some aerial imagery and someone look far ahead and give you some counter views, because nobody is the source of truth. And I think you need some broad views on that stuff.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you in terms of the expansive views. Brendan, final one, and this is like the terrible journalist question, but I was thinking like, how do I end this in like a futuristic, positive tone? And my brain at midnight was, you know, addled with thoughts. And I thought, what are like the next 5 years hold in prop tech? And fuck, it's so bad. So bad. I don't even want to ask it.
You sound like an LP right now.
What are the trends that we should predict? How do you want to finish it with that? Like, what should we expect? How do you think about it? What are you most excited for? Help me out.
Look, I think VCs should have two characteristics. One, they should be truthful. And two, they should be really supportive and promotional of their portfolio companies. So I'll answer it, but I'll make it very applicable to everyone on this phone. Like I said, there's billions of dollars of enterprise value on this phone in terms of prop tech that have been created in the last 4 years. And prop tech has grown 5x in the last 4 years. I think you're on the phone right now with over 100 or hundreds of billions of dollars of enterprise value right now between Hippo, States Title, and Blend. And I highlight that just to make the point that prop tech is 10 to 20x from here. And everyone on this call, I think, is going to be a big beneficiary of that. And so in some ways, I think this is allegorical of like where the future is headed in this space. This is the largest industry in the United States that is getting disrupted with technology. Hundreds of billions of dollars of enterprise value is going to be created, and it already has, and more is to come.
And what you guys didn't know is you were giving me 1% for the show today. I'm very appreciative. $4 billion of equity value. Thank you so
Deal.
Much.
You're welcome.
Listen, guys, this has been so much fun. Thank you for making it so easy for me, and it's just been a pleasure.
Likewise. Thanks,
Harry.
Thanks, Harry.
My word, I just love doing that show. Love the founders, love Brendan. So excited for the companies. Thrilled that I have 1%, as we said, from doing the show. What a productive and brilliant episode that was. If you'd like to see more from us behind the scenes, you can, of course, on Instagram at hstebbings1996 with 2 Bs. I always love to see you there. But before we leave you today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll.
and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Check them out at carta.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20VC listeners get 10% off at secureframe.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com. As always, I so appreciate all your support, and I can't wait to bring you a set of fantastic episodes next week.